Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. We're starting a new book, Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders and How They Changed America, 1789 to 1989, by Michael Beschloss. Michael Beschloss has brought us an inspiring saga about crucial times in America's history when a courageous president dramatically changed the future of the United States. You'll be in the room with the private George Washington, braving threats of impeachment and assassination to make peace with England. John Adams, incurring his party's unrelenting hatred by refusing to fight France and warning his enemies, "Great is the guilt of an unnecessary war." Andrew Jackson in a death struggle against the corrupt Bank of the United States. Abraham Lincoln, risking his presidency to insist that slaves be free. Michael Beschloss also shows us Theodore Roosevelt taunting J.P. Morgan and the Wall Street leaders who dominated his party. Franklin Roosevelt defying the isolationists and maybe the law to stop Adolf Hitler. Harry Truman risking a walkout by top officials to recognize a Jewish state. And John F. Kennedy, the belated champion of civil rights, complaining that he has cost himself a second term. And finally, 200 years after Washington, Ronald Reagan, irking some of his oldest backers to seek an end to the Cold War. Chapter 1. A Speedy Death to General Washington. In August 1795 at Mount Vernon, drenched by what he called a violent rain, George Washington nervously paced down a garden path, elegantly covered by crushed oyster shells. Washington was desperate to return to the national capital of Philadelphia, but the biblical torrents had washed out roads and bridges. Adding to his frustration, his mail had been cut off. Back inside, as the rains pelted his red shingle roof, spinning the Dove of Peace weather vane, the president bent over his candlelit desk, dipped a quill in back ink, and tensely scratched out letter after letter. He was feeling serious anxiety in a time of trouble and perplexities. For 20 years, since the start of the Revolution, Washington has taken as his due the bands playing "The Hero Comes" and the light-struck Americans cheering the man who unites all hearts. His anointment as president by the Electoral College in 1788 and 1792, both had been unanimous. But now the national adoration for Washington was fading. Americans had learned that a secret treaty negotiated by his envoy, John Jay, made demands that many found humiliating. One member of Congress said the fury against that damn treaty was moving like an electric velocity to every state in the Union. As the public tempest had swelled, some wanted Washington impeached. Cartoons showed the president being marched to a guillotine. Even the president's beloved Virginia, revolutionary veterans raised glasses and cried, "A speedy death to General Washington." With a national surge of anger towards Washington, some Americans complained that he was living as luxuriously as George III in England, the monarch they had fought a revolution to escape. Using old forgeries, several columnists insisted that Washington had been secretly bribed during the war by British agents. Still others charged that the president stole military credit from soldiers who had bled and died, stating, "With what justice do you monopolize the glories of the American Revolution?" Reeling from the blows, the 63-year-old Washington wrote that the infamous scribblers were calling him a common pickpocket in such exaggerated and indecent terms as could scarcely be applied to a Nero. One still friendly Gazette moaned, "Washington had been classed with tyrants and calumniated as the enemy of his country. Weep for the national character of America, for in ingratitude to her Washington, it is sullied and debased throughout the globe." President George Washington had brought the national fear upon himself by trying to avert a new war with Great Britain that threatened to strangle his infant nation in its cradle. In the spring of 1794, the British were arming Indians and spurring them to attack Americans trying to settle the new frontier lands that would one day include Ohio and Michigan. London was reneging on its pledge, made in the peace treaty ending the Revolutionary War with America, to vacate royal forts in the Trans-Appalachian West, Oswego, Niagara, Detroit, and Millinocket. Since Britain was at war with France, British captains seized U.S. ships trading with the French West Indies. Renouncing the agreed-upon border between the United States and Canada, Britain's governor in Quebec predicted a new Anglo-American war within a year. Former Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, who hated England and adored France, demanded retaliation against the British. But Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton warned the president not to plunge into a war that America could not win. The religious Martha Washington could not abide Hamilton's Byzantine intrigues or his infidelities to his wife, Elizabeth Hamilton. When Martha adopted a tomcat, she named it Hamilton. But for the president, who knew his own shortcomings, Alexander Hamilton was an endless font of provocative ideas, tactics, and language. During his first term, George Washington had told Hamilton and Jefferson that their gladiatorial clashes over foreign policy, economics, and personalities were tearing our vitals and had to stop. Instead, Jefferson quit in 1793 and organized an opposition. The new political chasm between Federalists and Jefferson's Republicans killed Washington's old dream of eternal national unity with no need for political parties. Retaining the president's ear, Alexander Hamilton urged him to send an envoy extraordinary to London. A new Anglo-American treaty could secure U.S. trade on the Atlantic and the Great Lakes, giving their country time to build its economy and defenses and settle its frontier. Then, if America one day had to fight off Britain, it would be far better prepared to do so. Washington agreed, but he knew Hamilton must not be the envoy. That would inflame the Jeffersonians. Instead, at Hamilton's suggestion, Washington chose the aristocratic chief judge, John Jay of New York. Privately, John Jay warned his wife that America might well have to battle England. But in May 1794, before sailing from Lower Manhattan to London, Jay promised a cheering crowd he would do everything to secure the blessings of peace. Soon after John Jay's departure, the British reclaimed and fortified one of their old posts on American territory near Detroit, Michigan. Having jeopardized his prestige to talk with Britain, Washington was furious. He told John Jay it was the most open and daring act of the British agents in America. Every well-informed American knew that the British were instigating all the difficulties that we encounter with the Indians, the murders of helpless women and innocent children. Washington noted that some wished him to turn the other cheek. He said, "I answer no. It will be impossible to keep this country in a state of amity with Great Britain as long as the posts are not surrendered." Jay got the British to forego such aggravations while they bargained. He assured Washington that Britain felt it was having a family quarrel with America and that it is time it should be made up. Jay reported that, excepting the king, the British respected no one more than George Washington. With such perfect and universal confidence in George Washington's personal character, they had taken John Jay's presence in London as strong proof of your desire to preserve peace. By the start of 1795, Washington heard rumors that John Jay had managed to broker a treaty, but the expected dispatch case never arrived. As it turned out, after making a deal in November, Jay had sent the president two copies of the treaty documents by a British ship that was seized by the French on the Atlantic. British sailors had thrown the papers overboard to keep them from French hands. That spring, another ship brought duplicates to Norfolk, Virginia. By stagecoach and horseback, a mud-caked, frost-bitten messenger rushed them to Philadelphia, where Washington received them at the president's house located at 190 High Street. In 1790, when Washington and his government moved from New York City to the temporary capital of Philadelphia, there was no official mansion for the president. Thus, the great man paid $3,000 a year to rent the four-story red brick home owned by Robert Morris, fiancé of the Revolution and the senator from Pennsylvania. Washington's rent would be about $60,000 today. When Philadelphia ceased to be the national capital in 1800, the ex-presidential mansion was broken up into shops and a hotel. In 1832, it was demolished. By the early 20th century, the land where Washington's home once stood in Philadelphia was the site of a public restroom. Robert Morris graciously moved next door to accommodate his old friend and gave him his four-story red brick house. George Washington found it the best single house in the city, but still inadequate for him. For instance, there were good stables, but for 12 horses only. During renovations of the home, which Washington financed, a house painter allegedly attacked one of the president's housemaids, who shrieked. Face dabbed with shaving cream, the half-dressed George Washington was said to have kicked the painter down the stairs, crying, "I will have no woman insulted in my house." The president's servants included 8 black slaves, selected from the almost 300 who lived at Mount Vernon. Knowing that Pennsylvania law freed any slave residing there for 6 months or more, Washington and his wife Martha made sure that each of the slaves was quietly sent home to Virginia every 5 months or so. "I wish to have it accomplished under pretext that I might be deceived both them and the public," Washington wrote a trusted aide, insisting that the ruse be none known to yourself and Miss Washington only. Upstairs at his mansion, George Washington frowned at Jay's Treaty of Amity, Commerce, and Navigation. He knew that if he approved the treaty, Americans would excoriate him for trucking to their old oppressor across the sea. Most inflammatory was Article 12, providing America could trade with the West Indies, but not with large vessels, nor could the U.S. export any products natural to those islands. John Jay's deal would also cosset the lucrative British fur trade in the American Northwest. The United States would pledge never to seize British assets in America, surrendering an important potential weapon for America's defense. Jay's treaty would also allow the British to keep on halting U.S. exports to France and to escape paying reparations for American slaves that they had carried off during the Revolutionary War. To keep public indignation from building against the treaty and before he sent it to the Senate, George Washington ordered Secretary of State Edmund Randolph to keep its contents rigidly secret from every person on earth, even from the rest of his cabinet. Unlike his successors, Washington took literally the Constitution's demand that a president ask the Senate's advice and consent on treaties. He would not finally decide whether to approve Jay's treaty until the Senate voted. Vice President John Adams feared the pact would be political trouble, stating, "A battle royale I expect at its ratification, and snarling enough afterwards. I am very much afraid of this treaty. Be very careful, my dearest friend, of what you say. The times are perilous." On Monday morning, June 8, 1795, 2 dozen U.S. senators in powdered wigs and ruffled shirts sat down in Philadelphia's Congress Hall for a special closed-door session on John Jay's treaty with Britain. Washington had insisted that the men in the emerald green Senate chamber discuss the treaty in absolute secrecy. The Aurora, published in Philadelphia by Benjamin Franklin Bosch, the Francophile, anti-Washington grandson of the famous founder, howled that the secrecy of the Senate was an insult to the sovereignty of the people. With no desire to pay for Bosch's daily outrages against decency, President Washington had long ago canceled his Aurora subscription. During 2 weeks of debate, Republican Aaron Burr of New York tried to pit Southern senators against John Jay's treaty by demanding that Britain pay up for the Negroes and other property it had stolen, mainly from the American South. But Southerners were far more aggrieved by Article 12's threat of their exports. Alexander Hamilton, by now a private citizen in New York City, advised Washington to scrap the article in order to save the treaty in the Senate. President Washington did so, and by a bare two-thirds vote along party lines, the U.S. Senate sent John Jay's treaty to the President's House for Washington to sign. To Washington's exasperation, the treaty's contents were no longer secret. A Virginia Republican senator, who reviled it, passed a copy to the French minister in Philadelphia, who gave it to Benjamin Franklin Bosch. Flamboyantly, his newspaper, The Aurora, ripped the veil off of what it called John Jay's illegitimately begotten treaty, that imp of darkness, approved by a secret lodge of senators. Bosch published the entire text in a pamphlet, which he sold up and down the eastern seaboard for 25 cents. His wife Peggy had no opinion about Jay's treaty. She simply hoped the proceeds would buy her family a new house. Fulminating that John Jay's treaty had made its public entry into the Gazettes, Washington knew that Bosch's attacks were just the start of a national onslaught. At midnight of Independence Day 1795, a Philadelphia throng burned a copy of the treaty and an effigy of John Jay. Crowds in other cities followed suit. Jay mordantly joked that soon he would walk through all 15 states by night, illuminated only by the glow of all of his effigies burning. Bitter doggerel described the President's envoy crawling on his belly to King George, stating, "May it please your highness, I, John Jay, have traveled all this mighty way to show all others I surpass in love by kissing of your ass." Girding himself for battle from his home seat of Monticello, Thomas Jefferson found John Jay's treaty an infamous act by the Anglo-men of this country. Jefferson warned, acquiescence under insult is not the way to escape war. With steam rising from Philadelphia's gravel seats, Washington pondered whether to sign the treaty. From New York, Hamilton wrote the president that his decision should be simple and plain. Except for Article 12, John Jay's pact with Britain was in no way inconsistent with national honor and would avert a ruinous war. Then in early July, a new British insult, a provision order that U.S. grain ships sailing towards France be stopped and their cargo confiscated. Edmund Randolph advised the president not to sign the treaty until Britain canceled the provision order. Washington asked him to so inform the British minister, George Hammond. Minister Hammond asked Randolph, the Secretary of State, whether Britain could suspend the order long enough to relieve the president's political problems in signing the treaty, then reinstate it. Randolph gave him no answer. When the Secretary of State reported the conversation, Washington sharply told him that she should have told Hammond that the president would never sign the treaty unless the provision order was permanently revoked. The protest was spreading. When Hamilton defended John Jay's treaty in front of New York City's hall, people threw rocks, leaving his face bloody. Someone joked that the crowd had tried to knock out Hamilton's brains to reduce him to equality with themselves. In Boston's harbor, mobs set a British ship aflame. In Philadelphia, they cried, "Kick this damn treaty to hell." Sparing a copy of John Jay's pact with a sharp pole, the revelers marched it to Minister Hammond's house, burned it on his doorstep, and broke his windows, with Hammond and his family cowering inside. Thomas Jefferson had not seen the American public pulse beat so full on any subject since the Declaration of Independence. The new Treasury Secretary, Oliver Wolcott, feared the demonstrations might signal the British that Americans sought war. He wrote his mentor Alexander Hamilton, stating, "The country rising into flame, their minister's house insulted by a mob, their flag dragged through the streets and burnt, can they believe that we desire peace?" George Washington found it extremely embarrassing for the British to see that the people of this country divided with such violent opposition to their own government. He told John Adams, his vice president, he suspected the demonstrations had been inspired by some sinister preconcerted plan to ignite an explosion in all parts of the 15 states. As the man who had sent Jay to London, the president knew that he could be immolated by the Firestone. One Federalist Gazette mourned that to follow Washington is now to be a Tory and to deserve tar and feathers. Chapter 2. Kick This Treaty to Hell. By mid-July 1795, George Washington yearned to escape the suffocating Philadelphia summer and sleep under the roof of his home house at Mount Vernon. There, after relaxation and well-informed investigation, Washington would decide without passion what to do about John Jay's treaty with Britain. He would not return to Philadelphia until the autumn chill vanquished the season's yellow fever epidemic. He wrote his Mount Vernon overseer, stating, "Have veal, mutton, and lambs in good order, for we already know that many intend to visit us there." After receiving two Indian chiefs, Washington climbed into a two-horse phaeton, followed by Martha and her grandchildren in a four-horse coach. He found the bumpy six-day journey home hot and disagreeable. One of his horses buckled under the heat and died. Stopping in Baltimore, Washington was handed a petition from Boston selectmen against John Jay's treaty, no doubt intended, Washington wrote, to make him embarrassed. Reaching Mount Vernon, the president told his diary, "Small westerly breeze, quite clear." In the mornings, Washington rose early for horseback rides across the ancestral domain that he had so exquisitely transformed. The cultivated beauty and timeless certitudes of his Mount Vernon plantation always steeled and grounded him for the unpredictable battles of the outside world. Washington wrote that, "Nothing pleases me better than to see his farmlands trim, handsome, and thriving, and nothing hurts me more than to find them otherwise." During his rides, Washington wore a broad-brimmed straw hat, his white hair in a single braid flopping behind his shoulders, as he surveyed his architecture, crops, and gardens, pungent with warm, newly laid fertilizer. He rode through swaying hollyhocks, past slaves and artisans at work, while his sheep and cows groaned. Glittering beyond was the blue and silver Potomac, speckled by ducks. Martha Washington was glad to be gone from Philadelphia, where the mandatory social life made her feel like a state prisoner. She had financed much of Mount Vernon, thanks to an inheritance from her late first husband, and people called her Lady Washington. But Abigail Adams found the president's wife modest and unassuming, with not the tincture of hauteur about her. During the summer of 1795, smarting from her husband's vilification, the 65-year-old Martha Washington felt infirmities of age and lowness of spirits. Soon the fracas over John Jay's treaty with Britain thundered into Washington's Mount Vernon paradise. Returning to his study, Washington donned spectacles and read the feathered reports from Philadelphia, stating, "The cry against the treaty is like that against a mad dog. People were running it down with the most abominable misrepresentations and working like bees to distill their poison, fighting for victory more than truth." Washington found a letter from New Jersey too rude to merit a reply. Of one from Petersburg, Virginia, stating, "Tenor, indecent, no answer returned." Of still another, Washington wrote that a Solomon was not necessary to understand the author's malign intentions. Writing to those letter writers who he deemed worthy of response, George Washington asked for a faith in his personal character, stating, "In every act of my administration, I have sought the happiness of my fellow citizens by ignoring personal, local, and partial consideration in favor of the permanent interests of our country and the dictates of my conscience." The president had yet to make up his mind about Jay's treaty with Britain. He wrote Randolph, his Secretary of State, that his current feeling was still what it was, namely not favorable to it. But he went on, if Britain canceled its provision order and the obnoxious Article 12 of the treaty, it was probably better to ratify it than to suffer matters to remain as they are unsettled. Reading from Chapter 2, Kick This Treaty to Hell, and George Washington's angst in trying to decide whether or not to back John Jay's treaty with Britain, and Michael Beschloss's presidential courage will be continued. This has been American History. This is Wallace Klinghammer, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.